file. I began my report that night over the autopsy reports, which I attached. Show a being of about 4 feet tall. The body seemed decomposed, and the photos themselves aren't of much use except to the curious. It's the medical reports that are of interest. The organs, bones, and skin composition are different from ours. The being's heart and lungs are bigger than a human's. The bones are thinner, but seem stronger, as if the atoms are aligned differently for greater tensile strength. The skin also shows a different atomic alignment in a way that appears the skin is supposed to protect the vital organs from cosmic ray or wave action or gravitational forces that we don't yet understand. The overall medical report suggests that the medical examiners are more surprised at the similarities between the beings found in the spacecraft. Note, NSC reports refer to this creature as an extraterrestrial biological entity, EBE, and human beings than they are at the differences, especially the brain, which is bigger in the EBE, but not at all unlike ours. I rode on into the first of many nights that year, drafting rough notes that I would later type into formal reports that no one would ever see except General Trudeau, reaching conclusions that seemed more science fiction than real. I was most happy, not because I was finally working on these files, but, oddly enough, because when I sat down to write, I believed these reports would never see the light of day. In the harsh reality of the everyday world, they sound, even now as I remember them, fantastic. Even more fantastic, I remember, were the startling conclusions I allowed myself to come to. Was I really writing this, or was it somebody else? Where did these ideas come from? If we consider similar biological factors that affect human beings, like long-distance runners, whose hearts and lungs are larger than average, hill and mountain dwellers, whose lung capacity is greater than those who live closer to sea level, and even natural athletes, whose long striated muscle alignment is different from those who are not athletes, can we not assume that the EBEs who have fallen into our possession represent the end process of genetic engineering designed to adapt them to long space voyages with an electromagnetic wave environment at speed, which create the physical conditions described by Einstein's general theory of relativity? Note for the record, Dr. Herman Oberth suggests we consider the Roswell craft from the New Mexico desert not a spacecraft, but a time machine. His technical report on propulsion will follow. Chapter 7, The EBE. Therefore, perhaps we should consider the EBEs as described in the medical autopsy reports, humanoid robots rather than life forms, specifically engineered for long-distance travel through space or time. A hot Washington summer morning had already settled over the Potomac like a wet towel on the day I finished the first of my reports for General Trudeau. And what a report it was! It set the tone for all the other reports and recommendations I was to make for the general over the next 2 years. It began with the biggest find we had, the alien extraterrestrial itself. Had I not read the medical examiner's report of the alien from Walter Reed with my own eyes and reviewed the 1947 Army photographs and sketches, I would have called any description of this creature pure science fiction. That is, had I not seen either this or its twin suspended in a transparent crypt at Fort Riley. But here it was again, just a yellowing sheaf of papers and a few cracked glossy prints in a brown folder sitting among scores of odds and ends, bits of debris, and strange devices in my nut file. Even stranger to me than the medical examiner's report was my reaction. What could we exploit from this entity? I wrote the general that whether we have found an extraterrestrial biological entity is not as important in the R&D arena as are the ways we can develop what we learn from it so that man can travel in space. This quickly became the overriding concern with all of the Roswell artifacts and the general format for all my reports. Once I swallowed back the "oh wow" aspect to all of this life-altering information, and sometimes it took a very big swallow, I was still left with the job of sorting out what looked promising for R&D to develop from what seemed beyond our realistic grasp for the present. I began with the EBE. The medical report and supporting photographs in front of me suggested that the creature was remarkably well adapted for long-distance space travel. For example, biological time, the Walter Reed medical examiners hypothesized, must have passed very slowly for the entity because it possessed a very slow metabolism, evidenced, they said, by the enormous capacity of the huge heart and lungs. The physiology of this thing indicated that it was not a creature whose body had to work hard to sustain it. A large heart, my ME's report read, meant that it took fewer beats than an average human heart to drive the thin, milky, almost lymphatic-like fluid through a limited, more primitive-looking and apparently reduced-capacity circulatory system. As a result, the biological clock beat more slowly than a human's and probably allowed the creature to travel great distances in a shorter biological time than humans. The heart was very decomposed by the time the Walter Reed pathologists got their hands on it. It seemed to them that our atmosphere was quite toxic to the creature's organs, given the time that passed between the crash of the vehicle and the creature's arrival at Walter Reed. It decomposed all of the organs far more rapidly than it would have decomposed human organs. This fact particularly impressed me because I had seen one of these things, if not the very one described in the report, suspended in a gel-like substance at Fort Riley. So whatever exposure it must have had was very minimal by human standards because the medical personnel at the 509th Walker Field got it into a liquid preservation state very quickly. Nevertheless, the Walter Reed pathologists were unable to determine with any certainty the structure of the creature's heart except to guess that because it functioned as a passive blood storage facility as well as a pumping muscle, that it didn't work the same way as did a four-chambered human heart. They said the alien heart seemed to have internal diaphragm-like muscles that worked less hard than a human heart muscle did because the creatures were meant to survive within a reduced gravity field as we understand gravity. As camels store water, so did this creature store whatever atmosphere it breathed in the large capacity of its lungs. The lungs functioned in ways similar to a camel's hump or to our scuba tanks and released atmosphere very slowly into the creature's system. Because of the large heart and the storage function we believed it had, we also surmised that it took far less breathable atmosphere to sustain the creature, thereby reducing the need for carrying large volumes of atmosphere along the voyage. Perhaps the aircraft had a means of recirculating its atmosphere, recycling spent or waste air back into the craft. Moreover, because the creatures were only 4 or so feet tall, the large lungs occupied a far greater percentage of the chest cavity than human lungs did, further impressing the pathologist to examine the creature's remains. This also indicated to us that perhaps we were dealing with an entity specifically engineered for long-distance travel. If we believe the heart and lungs seemed bioengineered for long-distance travel, so too was the creature's skeletal tissue. Although it was in a state of advanced decomposition, the creature's bones looked to the Army medical examiners to be fibrous, actually thinner than comparable human bones such as the ribs, sternum, clavicle, and pelvis. Pathologists speculated that the bones were more flexible than human bones and had a resiliency that might be related to the function of shock absorbers. More brittle human bones might more easily shatter under the stress these alien entities must have been routinely subjected to. However, with a flexible skeletal frame, these entities appeared well-suited for potential shocks and physical traumas of extreme forces and could withstand the fractures that would cripple human space travelers in a similar environment. The military recovery team at the Roswell site had reported that the two creatures still alive after the crash had difficulty breathing our atmosphere. Whether that was because they were suddenly tossed out of their craft unprotected into our gravity envelope, or whether our atmosphere itself was toxic to them, we don't know. We also don't know whether the one creature who died very shortly after the crash was struggling to breathe because he was fatally wounded by gunshots or because of other reasons. Military witnesses recounted different stories about the creature that survived and tried to run. Some said it was struggling to breathe from the moment the military had secured the area. Others said that it was gasping only after it had been shot by one of the sentries. My guess was that it was the alien's sudden exposure to the Earth's strong gravity that caused the creature to panic at first. That could have been one reason his breathing seemed labored. Then, after he fled and was shot, he was struggling to breathe because of his wounds. The medical examiner's report mentioned nothing about the toxic gases or the kind of atmosphere he believed the creatures naturally breathed. If the Roswell craft were a scout or surveillance ship, as the military analyst back at Wright believed, then it was also more than likely that the creatures never intended to exit the craft. This was a craft equipped with a device that was capable of penetrating our nighttime or utilizing the temperature differentials of different objects to create a visual image, enabling the occupants to navigate and observe in darkness. And because it could elude our interceptors and appear and disappear on our radar screens at will, we believe that the occupants simply stayed inside and observed, rather than roamed about. Perhaps other types of craft deployed from the same culture were equipped to land and carry out missions and therefore had breathing and anti-gravity apparatus on board for its crew that permitted them to exit the craft without suffering any consequences. The medical examiner didn't speculate on this. What did intrigue those who inspected the craft once it was shipped to Wright Field was the complete absence of any food preparation facilities. Nor were there any stored foodstuffs on board. At a time when space travel was a science fiction writer's fantasy, military analysts were already at work formulating ideas for just how such a technology could be practically implemented. It was not for travel to other planets, but for navigation around the Earth, because that's the technology the military planners believed the Germans were developing as an extension of their V-2 rocket program. If you're going to put airmen into Earth orbit, how do you process their waste products, provide adequate oxygen, and sustain them during prolonged periods? Clearly, after you've developed a launch vehicle with enough thrust to put a spacecraft into Earth orbit, keeping it there long enough for it to accomplish its mission is the next problem to tackle. The Roswell craft seemed to have tackled it because somehow it got here from somewhere else, but there was no indication of how such household problems as food preparation and the disposal of waste were solved. There was much speculation from the different medical analysts about what these beings were composed of and what could have sustained them. First of all, doctors were more tantalized by the similarities the creatures shared with us than they were concerned about the differences. Rather than hideous-looking insects or the reptilian man-eaters that attacked Earth in War of the Worlds, these beings looked like little versions of us, only different. It was eerie. While doctors couldn't figure out how these entities' essential body chemistry worked, they determined that they contained no new basic elements. However, the reports that I had suggested new combinations of organic compounds that required much more evaluation before doctors could form any opinions. Of specific interest was the fluid that served as blood, but also seemed to regulate body functions in much the same way as glandular secretions do for the human body. In these biological entities, the blood system and lymphatic systems seem to have been combined. And if an exchange of nutrients and waste occurred within their systems, that exchange could have taken place through the creature's skin or the outer protective covering they wore because there were no digestive or waste systems. The medical report revealed that the creatures were enclosed within a one-piece protective covering like a jumpsuit or outer skin in which the atoms were aligned so as to provide a great tensile strength and flexibility. One examiner wrote that it reminded him of a spider's web, which appears very fragile, but in fact is very strong. The unique qualities of a spider web result from the alignment of fibers that provide great tenacity because they're able to stretch under great pressure, yet display a resiliency that allows them to snap back into shape even after the shock of an impact. Similarly, the creature's spacesuit or outer skin appeared to be stretched around it as if it were literally spun over the creature and seized up around it, providing a perfect skin-tight protective fit. The doctors had never seen anything like it before. I think I finally understood it years later after I left the Pentagon and was buying a Christmas tree. As I stood there in the frosty air, I watched the young man who prepared the tree for transport insert it top first into a stubby barrel-like device that automatically spun a twine mesh covering around the branches to keep them in place for the trip home. After I got home, I had to cut through the mesh with a knife to remove the tree and separate the branches. This tree setup reminded me specifically of the medical report on the creature from the Roswell crash, and I imagined that maybe the spinning process of the creature's outer garment resembled something like this. The lengthwise alignment of the fibers in the suit also prompted the medical analyst to suggest that the suit might have been capable of protecting the wearer against the low-energy cosmic rays that would routinely bombard any craft during a space journey. The interior organs of the creature seemed so fragile and oversized that the Walter Reed medical analyst imagined that without the suit, the entity would have been vulnerable to the cumulative physical trauma from a constant energy particle bombardment. Space travel without protection from subatomic particle bombardment might subject the traveler to the same kind of effects he'd experience if he were cooked in a microwave oven. The particle bombardment inside the craft, if heavy enough to constitute a shower, would so excite and accelerate the creature's atomic structure that the resulting heat energy would literally cook the entity up. The Walter Reed doctors were also fascinated by the nature of the creature's inner skin. It resembled, although their preliminary reports didn't go into any chemical analysis, a thin layer of fatty tissue unlike any they'd ever seen before, and it was completely permeable, as if it were constantly exchanging chemicals back and forth with the combination blood-lymphatic system. Was this the way the creatures nourished themselves during their journeys, and was this how waste was processed? The very small mouths and lack of a human digestive system troubled the doctors at first because they didn't know how these things were sustained, but their hypothesis that they processed chemicals released from their skin and maybe even recirculated waste chemicals would have explained the lack of any food preparation or waste processing facilities on the craft. I speculated, however, that they didn't require food or facilities for waste disposal because they weren't actual life forms, only a kind of robot or android. Another explanation, of course, suggested by the engineers at Wright Field is that there would have been no need for food preparation facilities had this craft been only a small scout ship that didn't venture far from the larger craft. The creature's low metabolism meant that they could survive extended periods away from the main craft by subsisting on some form of military prepackaged foods until they returned to base. Neither the Wright Field engineers nor the Walter Reed medical examiners had an explanation for the lack of waste disposal on board the craft, nor could they explain how the creature's waste was processed. Maybe I was speculating too far about robots or androids when I was writing my report for General Trudeau, but I kept thinking also that the skin analysis that I was reading sounded more akin to the skin of a houseplant than the skin of a human being. That, too, could have been another explanation for the lack of food or waste facilities. Much of the attention during the preliminary and later autopsies of the creatures focused on the size, nature, and anatomy of their brains. Much credence was also given to the first-hand descriptions of on-scene witnesses who said they received impressions from the dying creature that it was suffering and in great pain. No one heard the creatures make any sounds, so any impressions Army intelligence personnel assumed would have to have been created through some type of empathetic projection or outright mental telepathy. But the witnesses said they heard no words in their mind, only the resonance of a shared projected impression, much simpler than a sentence, but far more complex because they were able to share with the creature's sense not only of suffering, but of profound sadness, as if it were in mourning for the others who had perished on board the craft. These witness reports intrigued me more than any other information we took from the crash site. The medical examiners believed that the alien brain, way oversized in comparison with the human brain, and in proportion to the creature's tiny stature, had four distinct sections. The creatures were dead, and the brains had begun to decompose by the time they were removed from the soft, spongy skulls that felt to the doctors more like palatal cartilage than the hard bone of a human cranium. Even had the creatures been alive when they were examined, 1947 medical technology didn't have ultrasound scanning or the high-resonance tomography of today's radiology labs. Accordingly, there was no way for the doctors to evaluate the nature of the cranial lobes, or spheres as they called them in the report. Thus, despite the rampant speculation about the nature of the creature's brains, thought projection, psychokinetic powers, and the like, no hard evidence existed of anything, and the reports were very light on real scientific data. Where the possibility of some evidence about the workings of the alien brains did exist was in what I refer to in my reports as the headbands. Among the artifacts we retrieved were devices that looked something like headbands, but had neither adornment nor decoration of any kind, embedded by some kind of very advanced vulcanizing process into a form of flexible plastic were what we now know to have been electrical conductors or sensors, similar to the conductors on an electroencephalograph or polygraph. This band was fitted around the part of the alien cranium just above the ears where the skull began to expand to accommodate the large brain. At the time, the field reports from the crash and the subsequent analysis at Wright Field indicated that the engineers at the Air Materiel Command thought these might be communications devices like the throat mics our pilots wore during World War II. But as I would find out when I evaluated the device and sent it into the market for reverse engineering, this was a throat mic only in a way that a primitive stylus can be considered a forerunner of a color laser imaging printer. Suffice it to say that in the few hours the material was at Walker Field in Roswell, more than one officer at the 509th gingerly slipped the thing over his head and tried to figure out what it did. And first, it did nothing. There were no buttons, no switches, no wires, nothing that could even be considered to have been a control panel. So no one knew how to turn it on or off. Moreover, the band was not really adjustable, though it had enough elasticity to have been a one-size-fits-all for all the creatures whose skulls were large enough to accommodate them. However, the reports I read stated the few officers whose heads were just large enough to have made contact with the full array of conductors got the shocks of their life. In their descriptions of the headband, these officers reported everything from a low tingling sensation inside their heads to a searing headache, and a brief array of either dancing or exploding colors on the insides of their eyelids as they rotated the device around their head and brought the sensors into contact with different parts of their skull. These eyewitness reports suggested to me that the sensors stimulated different parts of the brain while at the same time exchanged information with the brain. Again, using the analogy of an EEG, these devices were a very sophisticated mechanism for translating the electrical impulses inside the creature's brains into specific commands. Perhaps these headband devices comprise the pilot interface of the ship's navigational and propulsion system combined with a long-range communication device. At first, I didn't know, but it was only when we began development of the Long Brainwave Research Project toward the end of my tenure at the Pentagon that I realized just what we had and how it might be developed. It took a long time to harvest this technology, but 50 years after Roswell, versions of these devices eventually became a component of the navigational control system for some of the Army's most sophisticated helicopters and will soon be on the American consumer electronics market as user input devices for personal computer games. The first Army Air Force analysts and engineers, both at the 509th and at Wright Field, were also bedeviled by the lack of any traditional controls and propulsion systems in the crashed vehicle. Looking at their reports and the artifacts from the perspective of 1961, however, I imagine that the keys to understanding what made the craft go and directed its flight lay not only within the craft itself, but in the relationship between the pilots and the craft. If we hypothesized a brainwave guidance system that was as specific to the pilot's electronic signature as it was to the spacecraft, then we were looking at an entirely revolutionary concept of guided flight in which the pilot was the system. Imagine transportation devices in which the key to the ignition is a digitized code derived from your electroencephalographic signature and is read automatically upon your donning some sort of sensorized headband. That's the way I believe the spacecraft was navigated, by direct interaction between the electronic waves generated within the minds of the pilots and the craft's directional controls. The electronic brain signals were interpreted and transmitted by the headband devices, which served as interfaces. I never managed to obtain a copy of the Bethesda autopsy of the alien body the Navy received from General Twining. I only had the Army report. The remaining bodies were kept in storage at Wright Field initially, then they were split up among the services. When the Air Force became a separate branch of the service, the remaining bodies stored at Wright Field along with the spacecraft were sent to Norton Air Force Base in California, where the Air Force began experiments to replicate the technology of this vehicle. This made sense. The Air Force cared about the flight capabilities of the craft and how to build defenses against it. Experiments were carried out at Norton and ultimately at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada at the famous Groom Lake site where the stealth technology was developed. The Army cared only for the weapon systems aboard the craft and how they could be re-engineered for our own use. The original Roswell craft remained at Norton, however, where the Air Force and CIA maintained a kind of alien technology museum, the final resting place of the Roswell spacecraft. But the experiments in replicated alien craft continued to be carried on through the years as engineers tried to adapt the propulsion and navigation systems to our level of technology. This continues to this very day, almost in plain sight for people with security clearance who were taken to where the vehicles are kept. Over the years, the replicated vehicles have become an ongoing inner circle saga among top-ranking military officers and members of the government, especially the favored senators and members of the House who vote along military lines. Those who were shown the secrets are immediately bound by national security legislation and cannot reveal what they saw. Thus, the official camouflage is maintained despite the large number of people who really know the truth. I admit I've never seen the craft at Norton with my own eyes, but enough reports passed across my desk during my years at Foreign Technology so that I knew what the secret was and how it was maintained. There were no conventional technological explanations for the way the Roswell craft's propulsion system operated. There were no atomic engines, no rockets, no jets, nor any propeller-driven form of thrust. Those of us in R&D from all three branches of the service tried for years to adapt the craft's drive system to our own technology, but through the 1960s and 1970s fell short of getting it operational. The craft was able to displace gravity through the propagation of a magnetic wave controlled by shifting the magnetic poles around the craft so as to control or vector, not a propulsion system, but the repulsion force of like charges. Once they realized this, engineers at our country's primary defense contractors raced among themselves to figure out how the craft could retain its electric capacity and how the pilots who navigated it could live within an energy field of a wave. At issue was not only a great discovery, but the nuts and bolts chance to land multi-billion dollar development contracts for a whole generation of military air and undersea craft. The initial revelations into the nature of the spacecraft and its pilot interface came very quickly during the first few years of testing at Norton. The Air Force discovered that the entire vehicle functioned just like a giant capacitor. In other words, the craft itself stored the energy necessary to propagate the magnetic wave that elevated it, allowed it to achieve escape velocity from the Earth's gravity, and enabled it to achieve speeds of over 7,000 miles per hour. The pilots weren't affected by the tremendous G-force that built up in the acceleration of conventional aircraft because to aliens inside, it was as if gravity were being folded around the outside of the wave that enveloped the craft. Maybe it was like traveling inside the eye of a hurricane, but how did the pilots interface with the waveforms they were generating? I reported to General Trudeau that the secret to this system could be found in the single-piece skin-tight coveralls spun around the creatures. The lengthwise, atomic alignment of the strange fabric was a clue to me that somehow the pilots became part of the electrical storage and generation of the craft itself. They didn't just pilot or navigate the vehicle, they became part of the electrical circuitry of the vehicle, vectoring it in a way similar to the way you'd order a voluntary muscle to move. The vehicle was simply an extension of their own bodies because it was tied into their neurological systems in ways that even today we are just beginning to utilize. So the creatures were able to survive extended periods living inside a high-energy wave by becoming the primary circuit in the control of the wave. They were protected by their suits, which enclosed them head to feet. But their suits enabled them to become one with the vehicle, literally part of the wave. In 1947, this was a technology so new to us that it was as frightening as it was frustrating. If we could only develop the power source necessary to generate a consistently well-defined magnetic wave around the vehicle, we could harness a technology which would have surpassed all forms of rocket and jet propulsion. It's a process we're still trying to master today, 50 years after the craft fell into our possession. I pushed myself through the night to complete the report for the general. At least I wanted him to see that our strategy held out the probability that even in a basic evaluation of the material we recovered, the seeds were there for specific products we could develop. I wanted to start the entire process by writing him a background report about the nature of the beings we'd autopsied and what we could understand of the technology from an analysis of their spacecraft. By the time I finished, it was already just before sunup, and I looked like hell. This was the day I was going to drop my report on the general's desk first thing. I'd snap right to attention in front of him and say, "Here's my report you're waiting for, General," confident it contained more than he ever thought it would because the subject was that new and complicated. But I wanted to be clean-shaven and in a clean, crisp shirt. That's what I wanted. I didn't even need any sleep because my optimism and confidence at that moment were more powerful than anything a few hours of sleep could give me. I knew I was onto something here, something that could change the world. Here in the basement of the Pentagon, lying close to dormancy for over a decade, were secrets my predecessors had just begun to discover before they were stopped. Maybe it had been the Korean War. Maybe the CIA or other intelligence agencies had cast a pall over R&D's operation. But those days were over now. I was at the Foreign Technology Desk, and the responsibility for this material was mine, just like General Twining had said it should be 14 years ago. In those drawers, I had found the puzzle pieces for a whole new age of technology, things that were only a twinkle in the minds of engineers and scientists were right there in front of me as hard, cold artifacts of an advanced culture. Craft that navigated by brainwaves and floated on a wave of electromagnetic energy. Creatures who looked through devices that helped them turn night into day. And beams of light so narrow and focused you couldn't see them until they bounced off objects far away. For years, scientists had thought about what it would have been like to travel in space, especially since the Russians first put up their Sputnik. Plans for a military-operated moon base had been designed by the Army in the 1950s under the leadership of General Arthur Trudeau at R&D, but were ultimately shelved because of the formation of NASA. Those plans had tried to confront the issues of space travel for prolonged periods of time and adjusting to a low-gravity state on the moon. But here, right in front of us, was the evidence of how an alien culture had adapted itself to long-range space travel, different gravities, and the exposure to energy particles and waves crashing into a spacecraft by the billions. All we had to do was marshal the vast array of resources in the military and industry at R&D's disposal and harvest that technology. It was all laid out for us if we knew how to use it. This was the beginning, and I was right there on the cusp of it. So, in the first few minutes of glimmering light, just on the edges of the horizon, a promise of the day to come, I took off for home for a shower, a shave, a pot of coffee, and the crispest new uniform I could find. I was driving east into the dawn of a brand new age, my report right alongside me in my briefcase on the front seat. There would be other reports and the details of long-term complicated projects to confront me in the future, I knew. But this was the first, the foundation, the beam of light into a hidden past and an uncertain future. But it was a light, and that's what was important. No time for sleep now. There was too much to do. Chapter 8. The Project Gets Underway.
"This is a hell of a report, Phil," General Trudeau said, looking up from the paperclip sheaf of typewritten sheets I'd handed him first thing that morning. I'd been waiting at my desk since before 6 when I got back to the Pentagon, taking looks outside the building every once in a while as the bright orange reflection of the rising sun that exploded in the distant window and looked as if it had caught fire.
"What did you do? Stay up all night writing it?"
I put in some work after hours, I said. I don't want to spend too much time in the nut file when people are supposed to be working. The general laughed as he fingered through the paperwork, but you could see he was impressed. As much as I wanted to denigrate the Roswell file in front of him as a bunch of drawers full of stuff that people would put me away for, we both knew that it contained much of the future of our R&D. Military research and development agencies were under growing pressure from the Congress to put some success points on the scoreboard or get out of the rocket launching business for good. Early failures to lift off the Navy's whack corporal and the Army Redstone had made laughing stocks out of the American rocket program while the Soviets were showing off their success, like basketball players on fancy layups right across the court. The Army's Project Horizon moon base project was sitting in its own file cabinet gathering dust, and there was also a growing concern among the military that we'd be pushed into taking over the failed French mission in Indochina to keep the Viet Cong, the Pathet Lao, and the Khmer Rouge from making the whole area communist. It was a war we could not win, but that would drain our resources from the real battlefront in Eastern Europe. So even more than scoring some field goals, General Trudeau needed projects going into development to keep the civilian agencies from cutting us back and diverting our resources. Now my boss held my first report in his hand and knew that our strategic plan had some rational grounding. He pushed for a tactical plan. "We know what we want to do," he said. "Now how do we do it?" "I've been thinking about that too, General," I said. "And here's how I'd like to start." I explained that I wanted to compile a list of all our technical human resources, like the rocket scientist from Germany, then still working at Alamogordo in White Sands. I'd met more than my share of our rocket fuel and guidance specialists in the guided missile program during my years at Red Canyon in command of the Nike battalion, but we were working with theoretical scientists as well. Men with experience who could combine the cold precision of an engineer with the speculative vision of a free thinker. These were the people I wanted to assemble into a brain trust, people I could talk to about strange artifacts and devices that had no basis in earthly reality. They were the scientists who could tell me what the potential was in items like wafer-shaped plywood-thin pieces of silicon, with mysterious silver etchings on them. "And once you have that brain trust," General Trudeau asked, "then what?" "Match them up with technologies," I said. I admitted that we were flying blind on much of the material that we had. We couldn't go out to the general scientific and academic communities to ask them what we had, because we would very quickly lose control of our own secrets. Besides, a lot of it had to do with weaponry. And there were very strict rules on what we could and could not disclose without the appropriate clearances. But our brain trust would be invaluable. And with the proper orientation and security checks, they would keep our secrets too, just as they had since the end of World War II. "Which of the scientists do you have in mind?" Trudeau asked, taking out a little black leather-covered notepad he kept in his inside pocket. "I was thinking of Robert Sarbacker," I said. "Werner von Braun, of course. Hans Kohler. Hermann Oberth. John von Neumann." "How much they know about Roswell?" Trudeau wanted to know. If they'd been consulted on the Roswell material back in 47, as I knew that Werner von Braun had been by General Twining, then we weren't revealing any secrets. If they had never been informed about the crash, then we were going out on a limb by sharing information that was still classified above top secret. General Trudeau needed to know how dangerous it was to bring these scientists into the loop. But I assured him that all of them knew something about Roswell because of their connection with this research and development board. During the Eisenhower administration, information about the classified research and data collection projects into extraterrestrials was routinely filtered
to the Office of Research and Development because the head of the Research and Development Board had been one of the original members of the group. "I was at the White House when Sarbacher was, General," I told my boss, "so I can be pretty sure he was in the know. And Herman Oberth," I admitted to Trudeau, "he already told me that he believed that the objects we saw popping up on our radar screens at Red Canyon and then disappearing as if they were never there were probably the same kinds of extraterrestrial aircraft that we picked up at Roswell. So he knew, but I don't know how." "Well, that's good news at least," the general said. "I'd rather not be the one authorizing the release of classified information to anyone who didn't know it beforehand. And I don't want to put you in the position, Phil, of having to explain to any higher-ups why you decided to release top-secret information to people without clearances, even in the interest of national security." I appreciated that, but for our plan to work, we needed the technical and scientific expertise people like von Braun, Oberth, and Sarbacher could bring to any reverse engineering and product development strategies. "How will you approach him?" Trudeau asked. "We'll have to begin by taking inventory of all of the defense industry contracts we're currently managing, General," I said. "Line up the contracts and systems we're developing with the materials in the nut file to see where they fit in. Then, bring in the scientists to consult on making sure we know what we think we have. That is, if they can figure out what we have." "Let's go through a potential product list first," the general suggested. "Then see where our contracts line up and where the scientists can help." "And you know what happens then?" Trudeau asked. I wasn't sure where he was going to take this. "We're sticking you back in civilian clothes and sending you on the road to visit our friends in these defense contractors." "I don't even get to keep my battle ribbons," I joked. "I don't want anyone to know," General Trudeau explained, "that some lieutenant colonel on the CIA's most wanted list is traveling to our biggest defense contractors with a mysterious briefcase full of nobody knows what. You might as well wear a sign," he laughed. "We have to get to work on that list." That same afternoon, I went back to my report on the EBE and his craft and began to list the riddles it contained and the opportunities for the discovery of product it presented to us. The entire event was like an enigma to us because every conventional requirement one would expect to have found at the crash site, in the craft, or even in the EBEs themselves, was missing. Where was the engine or the power supply for the craft? It had neither jet engines nor propellers. It had no rocket propulsion like the V-2 missiles, nor did it carry any fuel. At Norton Air Force Base, where the craft eventually was hangared, engineers marveled at the thin amalgam of the most refined copper and purest silver they had ever seen that covered the ship's underside. The metal was remarkable for its conductivity, as if the entire craft was an electrical circuit offering no resistance to the flow of current. Yet it was something our military engineers could not replicate. By the 1950s at Norton Air Force Base, at least two prototypes of the alien craft had been fabricated, but neither had the power source of the craft that had crashed. In its stead were crude attempts at nuclear fission generators, but they were ineffective and dangerous. Even the portable nuclear generators that would power the primitive Soviet and American satellites in the 1960s were insufficient for the needs of the replicated spacecraft. So the question remained, what powered the Roswell spacecraft? I reviewed all of my discoveries in a checklist. The crescent-shaped space vehicle also had no traditional navigational controls as we understood them. There were no control sticks, wheels, throttles, pedals, cables, flaps, or rudders. How did the creatures pilot the ship and how did they control the speed, accelerating from a near stationary hover above a given spot like a helicopter to speeds in excess of 7,000 miles per hour in a matter of seconds? What protected the creatures from the tremendous G-forces they would have had to have pulled in any conventional aircraft? Our own pilots in World War II had to wear special devices as they pulled up out of dives that kept the oxygen from flowing out of their brains and causing them to black out. But we found nothing in the flight suits of these creatures that indicated they had faced the same problem. Yet their craft should have pulled 10 times the G-forces our own pilots did, so we couldn't figure out how they managed this. No controls, no protection, no power supply, no fuel. These were the riddles I listed. Alongside them, I listed that the craft itself was an electrical circuit. The flight suits, flight skins is a better description the creatures wore, were made of a substance whose atomic structure was elongated, strengthened lengthwise, so as to provide a directional flow to any current applied to it. The engineers who first discovered this were amazed at the pure conductivity of these skins, functionally like the skin of the craft itself, and their obvious ability to protect the wearer while at the same time vectoring some kind of electronic field. Where was the physical junction of the circuit between the pilot and the ship? Was it turned on and off somehow by the pilot himself through a switch we didn't know about? Alongside the riddle of the apparent absence of navigational controls, I listed the sensorized headband that so intrigued the officers at Roswell's Walker Field and fascinated me as well. As if, as we all suspected, this device picked up on the electronic signatures from the creature's oversized brains. What did it do with them? I believed, and our industrial product development from the 1960s through today, as the brainwave-controlled helmets finally came into service, ultimately confirmed that these headbands translated the brain's electronic signals into system commands that control the speed, direction, and elevation. Maybe the headbands had to be calibrated or tuned to each individual pilot, or maybe the pilots, since I believe they were genetically engineered beings biologically manufactured especially for flight or long-term exploration, had to be calibrated to the headband. Either way, the headbands were the interface between the pilot and the ship. But that still didn't resolve the question of the lack of cables, gears, or wires. Maybe the answer lay not in the lack of structural controls, but in the way the suit, the headband, the creature's brains, and the entire craft worked together. In other words, when I looked at the possible function of the entire system, the synchronicity between the brain interface in the headband and the pure conductivity of the spacecraft and the elongated structure of the space skins, which also acted like a circuit, I could see how directional instructions could have been translated by the headbands into some form of current flowing through the skins and into a series of raised deck panels where there were indentations for the creature's hands. The indentations on these panels, as the Roswell field reports described them, looked like the handprints pressed into the concrete at the old Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. Were the directional commands a series of electronic instructions transmitted directly from the creature's brains along their bodies through the panels into the ship itself, as if the ship were only the extension of the creature's body? For that to have been the case, something was still missing. The engine. Again, I settled on the idea of function over structure. The debris in the spacecraft indicated that an engine didn't somehow fall out of the craft when it crashed. A conventional engine was never there in the first place. What we found was that the craft seemed to have had the ability to store, as well as conduct, a vast amount of current. What if the craft itself were the engine, imparted with a steady current from another source that it stored as if it were a giant capacitor? This would be like charging a battery in an electric car and running it until the battery was drained. Sound far-fetched? It's not much different than filling up a car with gas at the pump and driving until the tank's dry, or fueling a plane and making sure you land before the fuel's gone. I suspected the Roswell craft was simply a capacitor that stored current and was controlled or vectored by the pilot and was able to be recharged in some way or could recharge itself with some form of built-in generator. That would have explained the power supply I noted alongside the riddle of the missing engine, but what was the means of propulsion and direction? If there was a force that functioned the same way thrust does, it wasn't immediately obvious how it was created or vectored. As early as September 1947, scientists who had gone to the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field to see the debris were speculating that the electronic potential of the Roswell craft reminded them of the German and British anti-gravity experiments of the 1920s and 1930s. General Twining was reported to have said more than once that the name of the Serbian electrical engineer and inventor of alternating current, Nikola Tesla, kept bubbling up in the conversation because the scientists examining the damaged craft described the way it must have converted an electromagnetic field into an anti-gravity field. And of course, the craft itself reminded them of the German experimental fighter aircraft that made their appearance near the end of the war, but that had been in development ever since the 1930s. Tesla and a number of other European scientists had been pioneers in the conversion of circumscribed small-area anti-gravity fields out of electromagnetic fields. However, the effort to develop true anti-gravity aircraft never came to fruition among conventional aircraft manufacturers because gasoline, jet, and rocket engines provided perfectly good weapons technology. But the theory of electromagnetic anti-gravity propulsion was not unknown, even if it was not well understood, and without a power source like a small portable nuclear fission generator, not at all feasible. But what if the flying craft already carried enough electric potential and storage capacity to retain its power, just like a very advanced flying battery? Then it might have had all the power it needed to propagate and vector a wave directionally by shifting its magnetic poles. If the magnetic field theory experiments carried out by engineers and electrical energy pioneers Paul Biefeld and Townsend Brown in the 1920s at the California Institute for Advanced Studies were accurately reported, and the U.S. military as well as scientific record keepers at Hoover's Young Bureau of Investigation kept very close tabs on what these engineers were doing, then the technological theory for anti-gravity flight existed before World War II. In fact, prototypes for vertical takeoff and landing disc-shaped craft had been on the drawing boards at the California Institute since before the war. It was just that in the United States, nobody paid them much attention. The Germans did develop and had flown flying discs, or so the intelligence report said, even though they had no impact on the outcome of the war other than stimulating a race between the United States and the USSR to gather as much of the German technology as possible. Thus, even though engineers had attempted to build vertical takeoff and flying wing aircraft before, and had succeeded, the Roswell spacecraft, because it was so truly functional and outflew anything we had, as well as traveled in space, represented a practical technological challenge to the scientists visiting the Air Materiel Command. We knew what the EBEs did, we just couldn't duplicate how. My reports for Army R&D were analyses of the types of technology that we had to develop to either challenge the spacecraft militarily with a credible defense or build one ourselves. In my notes to General Trudeau, I reviewed for him all the technological implications that I believed were relevant in my discussions about what could be harvested from the Roswell craft. I also wrote up what I understood about the magnetic field technology and how unconventional designers and engineers had drafted prototypes for these anti-gravs earlier in the century. All of this pointed in one direction, I suggested. that we now had a craft and could farm out to industry the components that comprised this electromagnetic anti-gravity drive and brainwave-directed navigational controls. We had to dole them out piecemeal once we broke them down into developable units, each of which